This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org if you're not listening there already. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me the independent filmmaker Frank Lopez. His first film, if I'm correct, was Join the Resistance, Fall in Love. He did a post-Katrina video remix after Kanye West called George Bush Don't Like Black People, and he does the online TV news series It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. His latest film, which I just saw this morning and I recommend, is the provocative NCIV, Resist or Die. It's about the ecological apocalypse we're facing and what we need to do to address it and not go over the cliff. Frank Lopez, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Tell me a little bit about your background and how you got into filmmaking.
Yeah, my dad used to run a TV station in Puerto Rico that was the first television station to be all news in Puerto Rico, but also was the first one that did investigative journalism on TV. And when I was in high school, I would go there and just mess around with the video editing equipment. And so I got hooked mostly on video editing, and I would produce short commercials for school dances and school activities that went over the closed circuit television system of my school. And so since then, I went to school for filmmaking, and I've just been making videos since I was 16 years old.
And is your dad still doing journalism in Puerto Rico?
No, he's kind of out of it, but he certainly still has his fingers in the political world, doing consulting for political candidates and speeches and whatnot.
And is he pleased that you followed in his footsteps, kind of?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have philosophical disagreements as to our politics, but we do understand that people have to fight. Like the focus of his politics is the decolonization of Puerto Rico. So most of the stuff that he does right now, the writing and everything, has that focus. And so I've been sort of injecting my politics into his head, just to show him where I'm coming from, especially when it comes to like environmental destruction.
Mm-hmm. And he was sympathetic, and you are then, with the Independentista movement?
No, my dad certainly is not.
He's the other way.
Yeah, he's pro-statehood, and I not necessarily agree with him on this either, but he definitely sees it as the only viable option to decolonize Puerto Rico. I have a lot of sympathies for the Independentista movement, but as it stands right now, they're a very, very small minority of the population.
Yeah, I heard in some elections it's down to 3-4%.
Yeah, they didn't even get enough in the last election to be put back on the ballot, which I think it's pretty sad, because I think their voice is important and it needs to be there.
No, I read in doing a little background work that you used to work at Democracy Now!, is that correct? What did you do there?
I was a television producer, so the TV producers at the end mostly do all the visual elements that happen on the show. So anyway, from grabbing news feeds from Reuters or other news services to producing graphics to going out on shoots.
And what was that like?
Probably the most intense working experience that I ever had in my life, with the most dedicated people I ever worked with. It was certainly a grind, but people who worked there are amazingly committed to the show and to getting information out there. And I find that it's rare. But I think if anybody wants to do media, they should look at Democracy Now! As a model on why being consistent and being dedicated, how that pays off.
You know, my only wish is that Amy Goodman could clone herself or get Democracy Now! Into, instead of a one-hour show, just a 24-hour thing or an 18-hour thing, so that people every day could see it consistently and have a station or a program of her own. I know she's not Rupert Murdoch. God forbid she ever be Rupert Murdoch. But if she had his resources, it would be a wonderful thing for the left in this country, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that the way she sort of spread the show using sort of a grassroots method is something that needs to be embraced. And I think it's really the only fighting chance we have against the corporate propaganda of the Rupert Murdochs of the world.
And right now, one of the only ways of getting our message across other than the internet is community radio, which he has exploited so well, and also cable access TV that was just lying fallow there in city after city across the country. And she was wise enough to push onto those stations. So my hat's always off to Amy Goodman. Tell me about this latest film, Frank Lopez, this film, End Civ, Resist or Die. How'd you get interested in doing that?
Well, actually, I had just been hired to produce Democracy Now!, and back then, it was this in 2006, the focus of my research and my journalism was peak oil or energy collapse, and Democracy Now! Had not done a show on the issue until that point, and so I was really pushing the producers to do a special on it, and In order to sell the show to the producers, I went to a peak oil conference in New York City, first one that ever happened. And it was great, you know, mostly a lot of talk about sustainability, you know, sustainable agriculture, alternative energy, cycling, et cetera. But about halfway through the conference, this kind of hippie-looking guy took the stage and spoke and basically changed the whole tone of the conference. This gentleman was Derek Jensen, and I had never heard of him until that day. And the reason why it touched me so much is that Derek was speaking very openly about resistance, about, you know, confronting the mechanisms that are destroying nature. And in the post 9/11 world and in New York City, even to speak so openly about the need to confront these mechanisms, to confront the corporations, etc., I found it very brave. And his talk was unbelievable. So even before I read his books, I knew that I was going to make a film about him, so I went and talked to him while he was signing books, and he said, let's talk. So I basically took the main ideas that he put forth in his Endgame books, which he splits it up into premises, and I took about four of those premises, and I sort of brought them to life. But I also use other voices from the radical environmentalist movement and also a lot of indigenous voices as well.
And you had some interesting filmmaking choices when you did it. I mean, the start is just an Agent Pac-Man game that I remember playing when I was in college many years ago, let's just say. Why'd you start with that? What was that imagery about?
Yeah, I remember interviewing Ward Churchill a few years ago, and I was asking him, like, you know, how would he describe, like, this culture of industrial civilization, which is basically the main critique that Derek puts forth in his books. And Ward said, you know, this civilization is like Pac-Man. It's just basically gobbling up, you know, resources and to a certain degree, people's souls and people's lives. And it's not going to stop until there's nothing left. And anybody who plays Pac-Man knows that the object of the game is to get rid of all the dots that are on the screen. And so I found that to be a fitting metaphor to sort of explain how this culture is just basically destroying the planet and sees nature as resources to be exploited, and that it won't stop until it destroys everything or unless we stop it ourselves.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today, Frank Lopez, who is the director of this film, End Civ, Resist or Die, Civ being civilization. Another filmmaking choice you make is you have the advertisements for fancy commercial products like diamonds, and then you show the slave labor making the diamonds, or you have the chicken, an ad for chicken with a factory farm behind that, or the ads for jeans with the sweatshops, the people making jeans. So you're just trying to pierce through, in some level, you know, people's awareness of what's, or lack of awareness of what's going on every day in commercial culture. And I thought that was really effective, too. You also, though, had the last in that sequence is Obama with lighting the Christmas tree. And what do you juxtapose that with some ground explosions? Is that mountaintop removal or is that a coal mining thing? What is that?
Yeah, it's certainly strip mining and mountaintop removal. And I think that, you know, to bring into today's terms, you know, Obama was big supporter of clean coal, so-called clean coal technology. For anybody who went to the Democratic National Convention, you could see the clean coal lobby had plastered the streets of Denver with their propaganda, and Obama was very much behind that. And, you know, the whole idea of that section was to basically show people that our lifestyle is violent, even though we ourselves don't directly conduct that violence. But, you know, for us to obtain that diamond, you know, there's bloody wars being waged in Africa. Or for us to get those cheap jeans from Target, people have to work in slave-like conditions. And for us to have those beautiful Christmas lights and all the electricity we need to power things, we need to destroy mountains in order to do it. And for me, the criticisms of Obama are not necessarily like just aimed at him. You know, if McCain would have been president at the time, then he would have been the target of these critiques. But we do have to understand that those in power are not really making the best choices when it comes to nature. And in this case, the Obama administration, you know, has repeatedly shown that nature is not a priority for them. You know, the fact that that mountaintop removal continues, the fact that now we're using hydraulic fracturing to extract gas and this basically destroying water tables all over this country is something that he's not going to oppose. And the fact that we started already drilling again in the Gulf basically shows a total disconnect as to what this sort of natural exploitation is basically doing, you know, not just to people in the third world or outside our borders, but right here in the United States. And so I think it's important to sort of spotlight that and focus on that.
And Frank Lopez, part of the critique of Obama that you see in the movie is the really not a critique of Obama, but critique of supporters of Obama, people who were holding the change signs in Denver and thought it would bring about real transformative change, and that change such as it is not much that much different than the way things were before. And so that leads you to a whole another level here in the film, a more provocative one about what needs to be done. I was struck by that, and I don't really agree with the thrust of the film, but I'm eager to discuss it with you. And that is this question of violence, or really it's a debunking, an attempt to debunk nonviolence as a tactic, I think. And I was surprised that you went there, and why was that important for you?
Actually, I think that maybe this is one of the shortcomings of the film. But what I was attempting to do with that section was not necessarily debunk nonviolence, because I think that nonviolence tactics can work in a particular context. What I was attempting to do with that section was to mostly show that there's people who write history, and that history is very meticulously refocused onto the things that the people who write the history want to refocus on. And so I take aim at the Gandhian myth. Not necessarily at Gandhi himself, because he was certainly an important part of the resistance movement in India, but the fact that in the left in North America, we get sold this idea that win was done strictly by nonviolent means and by the Gandhian tactics of pacifist resistance. And that's absolutely untrue. And it's, to me, is not only untrue and dishonest, but it's an insult to those who fought valiantly using other means, not necessarily all violent, but certainly more militant means to achieve that victory and to continue to put pressure on the British. And so when we look at the balance sheet of what the left, and in this case specifically, the modern environmental movement, we are seeing that the tactics are not working, that nature is being destroyed faster than what Greenpeace can save on the ground. And so when we're looking at the limits of nature and the fact that, you know, when you consider the issue of global warming, the fact that scientists, thousands of scientists, have reached consensus that we have a limited amount of time to go down to zero carbon emissions, which, to briefly explain, for those who don't get it, zero carbon emissions means that our entire infrastructure for daily life has to be either retrofitted where we don't burn any fossil fuels. I mean, the whole world, all of our food systems, all of our transportation systems, our electricity, all of that stuff runs on fossil fuels. All that stuff has to end. Bill McKibben is giving us 19 years to do that. Al Gore was a little more generous and gave us 39 years to do that. So when you consider that and you consider the fact that the politicians and the corporations, who are the ones who could really give us a soft landing and actually put all their resources into this, are not even moving in that direction. They're not even considering it. You know, when you look at what happened in Cancun last December at the COP16, all the first world nations did, including the U.S. and Canada, was subvert that process and sort of put it through a lens of industrial capitalism, again, through something called RED and RED Plus and carbon offsets and carbon markets. Our options for resisting the destruction of what we need to live, because without nature we don't live, are very limited if we just use the tools that are acceptable to the state, being nonviolence resistance. And I'm just trying to be realistic here and basically show people that what's at stake is the future of nature, is the future of the thing that gives us life. And we can't really get bogged down on putting people down who want to resist in a different way. And I think that we need all the tools on the table, and I think we need to have an honest conversation about history and about showing that even within the civil rights movement, which, you know, usually the spotlight gets put on Martin Luther King, there were usually militant outfits that were working in concert with that movement and that were very effective at putting pressure on the state.
I'm speaking with Frank Lopez. The film is NCIV, Resist or Die. You can actually go watch the film for free at NCIV, ENDCIV.com, and go watch it, as I did this morning. It's right there. It's for free. And it really makes you engage with these issues, the first issue being, look, the planet's being destroyed faster and harsher than anyone expected, and we don't have a lot of time left, as Frank Lopez has just been saying. And then the question of, what do we do about it, tactically, morally? What do we do about it? And Frank Lopez and people in the film, including Derek Jensen, who is the heart and soul of the film, go further than I would go in saying, one guy said, Jensen himself says, hypothetically, should we start picking off deforesters? That's not something I can get behind, but, it forces you, this film, to say, look, if the planet is going down so fast, what should we do? And I wonder about those kinds of comments from Jensen, or you start the film very quickly after that Pac-Man visual with Jensen quoting something ridiculous that Dianne Feinstein said, which is that everyone either in California or in the United States or on Earth has some God-given right to water their lawns. And that was a ridiculous thing for her to say. But then Jensen responds by, you can't respond to, there's no way to respond to that except with explosives. You set it up at the very beginning that you were going to go down this, or foreshadowed that you were going to go down this path, which I thought was a wise thing to do. But on the other hand, I just think to give people that the idea that they should go either picking off deforesters or sending Dianne Feinstein an explosive, if that's what Jensen meant, is... I question the morality of it. I question the tactics of it.
Mm-hmm. I think what Jensen was talking about, and what I was trying to do with that, was basically use the thing that Jensen is probably most known for those who have not really read his books. Jensen is known as the guy who wants to blow up the dams because he has a tremendous affinity with the salmon. And so I basically used that to spotlight, this is the one thing that he's really known for. But I just wanted to show that, you know, beyond that, there's like this larger analysis where it connects, you know, our culture's addiction to systematic violence in order to perpetuate a lifestyle that's wholly unsustainable.
But if the society is addicted to violence, why would you encourage people, or why would you quote people in the film urging violence?
Well, I mean, I think that language has tremendous limits. And I think that the things that we consider violence are maybe not necessarily violent. You know, a lot of resistance has been happening in this country through its history of property destruction. And to me, the destruction of inanimate objects is not violent. Also, in this country, we celebrate the heroes of the independence movement of this country, which is an extremely violent movement. But we celebrate them, and we have really no problem with that. And I think that when it comes to the defense of those we love, if we saw somebody attacking those we love, we would certainly use violence, if necessary, to defend those people. And so I think that most people would take a knee-jerk, moralistic response to violence, or to even that word violence, when in reality most people would go down that path if the things that they love were going to be destroyed. And in the film, I purposely focus on the example of Oka, the Oka crisis in Quebec, outside of Montreal. And just briefly, what happened there was a Mohawk community had some sacred pines that they used as a burial ground. And city council wanted to destroy those pines and expand the local golf course. And the Mohawks used all the legal means possible to stop that. And city council basically just laughed at them. And so when the destruction of those pines was about to happen, the Mohawks picked up arms, set up blockades, and defended those trees with their life, and won. And, you know, it was important to highlight this in the North American context, but the kicker, and this is really what the whole film can be sort of summed up by the statement that this one Mohawk woman made, which is, we treat these trees and the land like our mother. These people are raping our mother. What would you do if they rape your mother? And I'll tell you, I know what I would do if I saw somebody raping my mother. And right now, the planet's being raped, and we're bearing witness to it. And all of us here in North America and our comfortable lifestyle that is essentially complicitly violence by our inaction, it's just something that we have to sort of reframe and basically look at nature as if it's our life giver, because it is.
That's Frank Lopez talking about his new film, End Civ, Resist or Die, and you can go see it for yourself and come to your own conclusions. Don't take mine for granted or without inspection. Go to endciv.com, endciv.com. Some of the more powerful sequences in this film, Frank Lopez, were those with Native American speakers. I thought that Mohawk segment was great. The visual was great because you saw the golf course encroaching on the trees, and next to the trees is the cemetery of the Mohawks. And so that was really powerful. There was one Native man from Canada who I read has since died, who was extremely powerful in his presentation and in the video, the visuals with him standing behind a beautiful lake there in Canada. What was his name, and tell me about him.
Yeah, Quatsinas is somebody who became a really good friend of mine. He's a hereditary chief of the Nuhak Nation, and the Nuhak live in an area that settlers called Bella Coola, which is in the central coast of British Columbia in Canada. And they have a beautiful rainforest that environmentalists, for PR reasons, called the Great Bear Rainforest. And that was being clear cut. You know, a lot of old growth, some of the last old growth left in the West Coast. And he's been a fighter for his people, or he was a fighter for his people all the way till the very end. What the Nuhak experienced that for me was sort of bring this whole theoretical idea of industrial civilization and how it colonizes and destroys out of the theoretical and into the real world. What Quatsinas told me is that his people used to live in that land without money, without systems of control. They freely traded with their neighbors in Bella Bella. They had abundance of food, abundance of salmon, abundance of game meats and berries and all kinds of other things. And industrial civilization, or civilization itself, has not even been in that land for even 200 years. And the population of his lands, of his people, was reduced to the hundreds through the dissemination of smallpox, purposeful dissemination of smallpox. And now you go to Bella Coola, and instead of them having like free access to their land, because that land is still unceded, that no treaty has been signed when it comes to their land, and as it relates to the Canadian government. Now they live in small reserves, as they're called in Canada, even though they're the majority of the people in that town. And their diet consists of canned meats and canned vegetables and white bread that gets shipped from thousands of miles away. And they suffer from afflictions that they never suffered from before, like diabetes and cancers and also alcoholism. And the salmon has been almost completely decimated in that part of the world. And a small fish that only lives in that part of the world called the Uligan is almost extinct. And so when we look at these examples and we looked at there were people who actually lived sustainably with the land for tens of thousands of years, and we've seen how they've been completely deprived of their traditional way of living, I think that we need to sort of apply that context to our larger situation because it's basically the same. But also understand that indigenous people are still here. They know how to live in the land. And they can certainly teach us how to live sustainably. But we just have to listen to them. And I really wanted to amplify their voices because you rarely see media that does so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really, really good part of this film called NSIV, Resist or Die. And the Native peoples have been resisting for a long time. You say, or Derek... says in this book, Derek Jensen, who's the author of Endgame, says civilization should end, and the sooner the better. I remember talking with Bill McKibben, and I don't believe he signed on to that because he was worried, as I am, that, you know, if civilization ends, you know, what happens to all the people here? I mean, so I know that's shorthand. Civilization should end, and sooner the better. Industrial capitalist civilization that pollutes should end. Lord knows it has to end within the next, as McKibben said, 19 years, or we're going to be almost, well, the planet won't be our planet. It's not our planet right now. It's a different planet, as he put it. But what are the human costs of just kind of shutting down industrial capitalism as we know it right now?
The human costs would be that people in the third world would start to have access to their land back again. They wouldn't have to be producing widgets and trinkets for us, working in maquiladoras and working in sweatshop conditions. It would mean that the U.S. military could not go out and murder millions of people as it does around the world to bring resources back to us. It would mean that small communities could regain power and really localize power once again and start figuring out ways to live sustainably. I mean, all I see is positives. I mean, I see nature for once giving a chance to recuperate and rebuild itself. And what I see right now is an empire or dying empires going down. And as empires go down, mostly because they're addicted to these resources, are go down kicking and screaming. And so if we don't stop them now, they're going to destroy what's left in their goal of remaining alive or remaining an empire. And if the tar sands and hydraulic fracturing and the developing of the tar sands in Utah and the fact that they're looking for methane hydrates in the bottom of the ocean and they're drilling deeper than ever is any indication that they're desperate for this oil and for these resources, then I don't know what is. I mean, we have to sort of see this as humanity's last stand to save nature once and for all, and to also to free ourselves.
Frank Lopez has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. He's the director of this provocative movie, NSIV, Resist or Die, and I encourage you to go to the website, endsiv.com, see it for yourself and wrestle with these issues. You quote in the film, Frederick Douglass, power concedes nothing without a struggle. One of my favorite quotes. Really interesting movie, and it's been interesting, very interesting talking to you, Frank Lopez. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Absolutely. Thanks, Matthew.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.